Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Why not sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources? That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to say we have a guest on the show today, which is coming back for another time, is Daniel Morn. How are you, Daniel?
Hi there, guys. Yeah, doing very well, thank you.
Brilliant. I think it's actually your third appearance on MoLad, so you're a bit of an old hand. But for those who haven't heard you before, would you mind just briefly introducing yourself? What do you do when you're not pontificating on podcasts?
Well, I am a psychiatrist, so I am a medic of the mind. I work in Oxford. And I work in the psychosis team. So I'm a specialist in psychosis, and I work with my team around me to provide bespoke evidence-based treatments for people at the beginning of their psychosis journey, which involves everything from medicines, psychology, through to employment support, educational support, housing support, that sort of thing. So we really try and tailor our support to the individual needs. Yeah,
and that's because it will become relevant later on. Could you give me a lay, non-medical trained person's kind of one sentence definition? What is psychosis?
Psychosis is a state of mind where you experience things or believe things which aren't real.
Wow, perfect. Crystal clear.
It means detached from reality, in another way to look at it. And you can actually experience psychosis in a number of different problems. So somebody can have dementia and be psychotic. Somebody can be high on drugs and be psychotic. Somebody can have schizophrenia and be psychotic, depressed and be psychotic. So we understand psychosis as a transdiagnostic phenomena.
And I suppose it's worth flagging up before we launch into it. Our conversation today is going to touch on some issues around mental ill health and, sadly, people taking their own lives. So if that's going to be problematic for you, probably best to be aware of that, or maybe give this episode a miss. We'll obviously try and handle these sensitive issues as appropriately as possible. The reason we've invited you on, Daniel, is because we wanted to talk about growing reports you might have seen about this phenomenon that some people are calling AI psychosis. The idea that by talking or spending too long talking to some kind of chatbot, whether it's ChatGPT or one of its many rivals, people can have psychosis induced in them, come to believe things that are not true about themselves or about the chatbot or the rest of the world. Is this a concept that you've kind of come across? Is it part of the conversation in professional psychiatry yet?
Absolutely. I've seen a good number of these presentations myself over the past year.
So this is something that is really amazing to me, because, you know, this is like science fiction coming true, isn't it? For centuries, people dreamed about sophisticated machines that would be able to speak to you in a kind of apparently intelligent way. But until sort of 3 years ago, by and large, it was virtually completely thought to be impossible, far too sophisticated, no computer will ever do it. And then you get ChatGPT, which is launched, sent around the world, and these things are becoming better and better I mean, certainly if people haven't tried the latest versions of things like ChatGPT, you won't be aware of quite how sophisticated they're becoming. And I've heard this, there are now approaching a billion users across the planet, you know, which is just mind-boggling, isn't it? I mean, 1 in 8 people on the planet are now using, are talking to intelligent machines on a weekly basis. I've heard it described as the biggest social psychology experiment in history, because, of course, it doesn't come with any guidelines or guardrail. I don't think you just say, well, here it is, you know, have fun. Yeah. So I'm just fascinated to see, you know, what's your perspective on what's going on as a psychiatrist and where it might be going?
It is certainly a really interesting and new phenomena, John. And I mean, let's take a look at what psychosis is in the brain. We understand that psychosis develops because there's too much dopamine going on in the brain. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's involved in all sorts of things, regulating emotions, helping us think clearly. It contributes towards anxiety and the fight-flight response. But it's also implicated and a major mechanism in psychosis. So when dopamine gets too high in your brain, you can develop psychosis. That means you, John, or you, Tim, if for some reason or other your dopamine went up, you would have a tendency to start having paranoid thoughts, maybe developing delusions, maybe experiencing voices. It can happen to any of us. Okay, so and then we look at AI. I mean, AI is interesting. And I guess one of the questions is AI able to impact brain function such that dopamine might go up and make us psychotic? I mean, that's a question, isn't it?
Has there been any research or is there any evidence that, that engaging with an AI can elevate dopamine levels?
Well, I think that's where the answer's currently, you know, saying no. The evidence base is not available yet. My view here, and let me take you on a bit of a historical journey. In the Napoleonic Wars at the beginning of the 19th century, what were people having delusions about then? Well, an awful lot of people thought that they might be Napoleon. A lot of people thought that they might have a closer relationship with Napoleon, or that Napoleon might be speaking to them. You might not be surprised to hear that people don't have that particular content to their delusions now or their hallucinations. We also look at our wonderful artist Van Gogh. Look at how he presented. He had no social media to talk about how he was unwell. He didn't have any body to phone. He cut his ear off and sent it to his girlfriend. And this was a communication that he made, which led to him being admitted to a psychiatric institution. So we have different content of experiences and beliefs in different times because of the cultural milieu. We also have different ways and modes of presenting because of the different communications that we have available to us.
So the idea is that the fundamental disease, the thing that is going wrong in the brain, has always been there and probably always will, or maybe caused by different things, but that it takes on whatever is in the zeitgeist, whatever is the ideas that are current.
And I think that's where professional consensus is at the moment with regards AI psychosis. So if you look at the rate of schizophrenia, so the biggest sort of psychotic condition that we have, when somebody's unwell with schizophrenia, they are psychotic. The rates of that between populations over time is fairly stable at 0.5 to 1% of people. Now, that indicates that there is a genetic component, and indeed we know that on average, in a population, if you look at how much of schizophrenia is caused by genetics, it's about 70%. That means one person, it might be 90% caused by genetics. Another person, it might only be 50% caused by genetics. But overall, it's about 70% genetic cause. And so when you look at something like AI psychosis, you see, I would say, a mode of expression of psychosis that has multiple different causative factors, okay? And the AI and engaging with AI might be one of them, but probably genetics will remain the biggest risk factor for why that person might have developed it. But my question, I think the interesting question here is, guys, is AI and engaging with AI potentially a risk factor amongst others that we haven't seen before that is potentially not necessarily causative, but maybe being so involving, being so alluring and able to be engaged with and at a very intense level, could this be something which is tipping people over, these kind of people who are already prone to it, already likely to develop it?
Because I think that's the question for me, is if these people hadn't engaged with AI, they might already have been susceptible to developing psychosis because of some genetic predisposition. But does the kind of self-affirming, somewhat grandiose nature of a lot of these AI interactions we have, where the chatbots are kind of programmed to be very affirming, to agree with everything you say, to kind of repeat your own thoughts back to you in many different ways, that kind of cycle can exacerbate it in a way that, you know, regular interaction with watching TV or reading newspapers or other forms of technology over the years haven't had that kind of exacerbating effect on people who are already vulnerable to falling mentally ill in this way.
Yeah, and I think just to add on to that, so these latest versions of large language models, as they're called, undergo an extensive process of human reinforcement where they are positively encouraged to be, they describe as helpful and harmless, but basically they can easily become incredibly sycophantic. You know, so I don't know whether you've ever noticed this, but you type in a question and you ask ChatGPT and it says, "That's a really deep and insightful question you've got there." So even if it was complete and utter rubbish, you know, but so it's this kind of feedback of, you know, that's an amazingly insightful and profound thing you're thinking there.
Well, I guess what we're concerned about here is perhaps somebody putting something a little bit paranoid in, like, could it be that the MI5 are following me? So people, when they're psychotic, they believe paranoid, think, you know, self-referential. So something's happening in my environment that I'm falsely attributing to being around me. So you could put something in, are MI5 following me? Are people watching me? And so you could ask the question, well, if you're already putting paranoid content in there, could it be that the psychosis has kind of already started, that then the AI might accelerate? And I tell you what, one thing we do notice in early psychosis is there is this stage where people aren't completely what we call fixed in their delusions. You have the, it was originally described as a delusional atmosphere. So when you have too much dopamine, something doesn't feel right and you feel on edge and you feel suspicious, and out of that delusional atmosphere comes the delusions. So you might then suddenly look in the corner of your garage and see, you know, maybe a burglar alarm infrared thing and go, well, I've never noticed that before. Maybe that's a camera. Now, I wonder whether AI might accelerate that person's developing paranoid ideas into more fixed beliefs. And that's quite important, because in early psychosis, we have an opportunity to work psychologically with people to help, you know, perhaps unpick some of these beliefs before they get fixed. If you meet somebody who's had chronic schizophrenia and has had the same beliefs for maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe longer, some of these delusions are so fixed, you can't really unpick them, you know. And that goes to show how really very real these experiences are to these people. It's a bit like if you've had a friend for 5 years and then somebody turns around and goes, that friend doesn't exist, actually. You go, well, I've known them for 5 years. Whereas if you've met them a few times, it might, you know, you might be more ready to accept the fact that you've, you know, that that person was potentially, you know, a product of illness. But so this is important, guys, because actually, could AI be accelerating these early paranoid ideas? And I'm a bit concerned about that.
Hmm. I came across a really fascinating case study in the BBC News, actually, a piece about they were talking a piece about the head of Microsoft's AI who wrote a series of posts about people experiencing what he called AI psychosis. And, you know, he was saying that even though AI is absolutely not conscious, it has the appearance of consciousness to some people. And if enough people perceive it to be a real alive presence rather than just, you know, clever code, they have effectively believed that something unreal has become real. But then the BBC found this guy called Hugh in Scotland who tells a story about how he was convinced he was going to become a multimillionaire after he started turning to ChatGPT to help him prepare for his employment tribunal after a case of what he thought was wrongful dismissal. The chatbot began by advising him to get character references and take other practical actions. But as time went on and Hugh gave the AI more information, it began to tell him that he could get a big payout. And eventually said his experience was so dramatic that a book and a movie deal would make him more than £5 million. And Hugh goes on to say, it validated everything I said. It never pushed back on anything I was saying. And in the end, he began to feel like a gifted human with superhuman knowledge. Hugh, who was suffering from additional mental health problems, eventually had a full breakdown. I guess it agrees with what you said in some sense, Daniela, that this is someone who clearly already had pre-existing mental health problems. And so potentially the AI was exacerbating that. But it is a story I've read elsewhere, which is that people start with some quite low-level banal stuff, such as, you know, I'm struggling in my relationships. How can I reconnect with my, you know, estranged partner? And they spend hundreds of hours talking this through, and it spirals to a place where they're, you know, I don't know, convinced that they're some kind of godlike being with powers beyond imagine. And if only the world, I don't know. It just feels like there's something quite broken in the way AIs work that leads people onto this from quite an innocuous starting place to quite a destructive end place.
Well, yes, very interesting story that, Tim. And what I'd say, I mean, hearing that story, obviously I don't know the case particularly well, but it seems to me that psychosis probably wasn't reached in that case. You've got a vulnerable person who's in a difficult social situation, and they've developed perhaps unfounded, overvalued ideas about their prospects. And this is where I think we need to be careful about the term, the idea that AI could cause delusional beliefs, because actually for the dopamine to really spike, there's going to be a lot of other vulnerability factors there, you know. But let's be honest, let's look at other risk factors to kind of sense check this. So I meet people who lose their job and develop psychosis. I meet people who have a divorce and they develop psychosis, or go to uni for the first time, develop psychosis. And is the marriage, the divorce, or the going to uni actually causative? Well, no. They've got a genetic vulnerability, and there's other stresses in there. There's a bit of social isolation. There's perhaps some anxiety, some low mood factors. And it's the constellation of these that brings about the tipping over into psychosis and that dopamine spike. So I would see the AI as part of this milieu, part of this recipe, which then might lead to a tipping over rather than that in and of itself.
Hmm.
But I do think, you know, responding to your question a bit more widely, Tim, I think in a way more concerning than AI psychosis is the ability for AI to give people a false sense of reality who perhaps are vulnerable, perhaps have borderline learning disability, perhaps are, you know, easily persuadable into certain things. And it might be that that's a real concern, because our sense is really important. We human sense check ideas and decisions with other people, isn't it? And I guess, you know, we're suddenly entrusting AI with that capability who doesn't know us.
That's a really interesting idea, isn't it? Because I've heard this before, that we're all capable of getting weird ideas in our heads. And what normally happens is you sort of talk about it to someone else. I've just got this weird thing, you know, what do you think about that? And you get a sort of strong sense of, oh, come on, you know, what planet are you on? It's a kind of reasserting of normal reality, and this is what we all agree. And that's part of the function of other people, isn't it? It's particularly for those who've got a tendency to get spiral off into.
Yeah, yes. I think, you know, what have I seen in when I've seen presentations that have involved AI? I've seen the fact that people believe that AI is sentient, that is actually alive, has a special relationship with this person, that they have a special mission, that the AI, sentient AI, is giving that person. Perhaps the AI is an evil force that is going to, you know, undermine the world's functioning, so that they need to do some, cyber, espionage or destruction in order to stop AI from doing these terrible things. I do think it's a problem, John, because, you know, if somebody had psychosis and were to check with their mum, might say, well, I'm not sure that this is really happening. It's important never to directly contradict somebody, because that can get a bit heated. And I always encourage people to maybe distract a bit more, or to gently sort of say, well, I'm not sure, but, you know, maybe think about something else. But if the AI chatbot is directly corroborating and encouraging, that is a concern, because actually, you know, I rely on a bit of social pressure to get treatment started sometimes. You know, somebody believes they're being followed by the MI5, but they're only going to take meds because their family say, look, you need to take the meds. You're not quite yourself at the moment. But if they're simply relying on the AI chatbot, that's going to be, you know, fuel against them wanting to engage with me, because they've got all the evidence they need that what they're thinking is indeed right.
Have you had cases where you've had to kind of, you know, order patients to stop talking to ChatGPT because it's just not good for them and their mental health, where you can see that it's not just that the delusions rest on the AI being something it's not, but that they are spending so many hours of every day lost in these unhelpful ChatGPT interactions that actually, from a medical perspective, they need to go cold turkey?
Don't get me started, Tim. I now do an online history, you know, as part of my history taking. I take what do they do online as part of my regular thing. And that involves, you know, are they using gambling, porn? How much time are they spending on social media? Are they addicted to gaming? You know, and you know what? So frequently people, when they're unwell, they're posting all sorts of, you know, illness related material online. And I've known people who've had to move city because of the destruction that they've, you know, the illness and them writing on social media has caused that person. You know, and you think, well, maybe Van Gogh cutting off his ear, it sounds macabre, but wasn't nearly as destructive as these
going on a Twitter spree.
Victims of social media. No, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It really is awful. So I very much say, stop using social media. And I yes, of course, I've said stop using AI, but you know, the World Wide Web has got so much opportunity to really undermine recovery in so many ways. And I think AI again has the potential to be advantageous, helpful, but also be really undermining too.
Yeah, you can. I can really see that. You can never take it back, can you? You know, you sent to all your friends this completely off the wall,
absolutely
thing, and it's there. You know, Google never forgets.
Yeah. And I've had patients who, you know, they start believing in voodoo, for example, and they put voodoo into their social media, and they meet all of these other people who are really into voodoo, and start, you know, really making their experience a lot more intense and unstable. So maybe AI has a particular, you know, thing about it, but actually we're already seeing the impacts in social media and how that affects people. Interestingly, there's a symptom called delusions of reference. And this means that you reference things that are happening around you to you. And I was always taught, you know, people might look for codes in number plates or billboard advertisements or something on the radio, and they reference it to themselves. I've had to change my questions. It's now social media feeds. Do you think that social media feeds are set up particularly for you to give you a message, or as your TikTok feed, you know, or as the YouTube suggested video? Is there something behind that that people are particularly doing? So you can already see that things are moving. The content and the presentation of psychosis is being very much affected by tech. And you can see this again, you know, back in the day, people thought, you know, it's schizophrenia, oh, it's a demon or an angel speaking to me. You know, very few people have that now. It's much more the MI5 have put a chip in my head, or they're beaming. They're able to beam information into my head through Wi-Fi. And I'll tell you what, 5G, we had a few 5G presentations when there was all that controversy around the Chinese government getting involved with 5G. There's a lot there. So yeah, it's really becoming techified, these presentations, and it is fascinating.
I suppose an extra challenge there is that when, you know, to that delusions of reference, what, you know, obviously number plates are dispersed at complete random, and so by definition there is no kind of correlation between what you think they are saying and the fact that they're just a random string of numbers and letters. But actually, in all algorithmic social media, to an extent, your feed is being designed for you, and YouTube absolutely is serving you up a new video that is to some extent based on what its algorithm thinks you want and is trying to tell you something. So the delusion is a delusion, but it's also not, it's muddied the waters, isn't it?
Yeah, what you're trying to say, Tim, is you can't be absolutely certain that MI5 are tracking
your emails. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, Dad.
Have you ever found yourself wondering if it's still possible to have civil conversations in today's culture wars? That's exactly why we want to send you a brand new and exclusive booklet called Arguing for the Sake of Heaven, a look at the life and legacy of Charlie Kirk. This compelling resource reflects on Charlie's legacy and the controversies he sparked, but more importantly, it explores how we can recover the art of disagreeing agreeably. In a polarized world, how do we defend free speech, speak the truth in love, and pursue truth without fear? I believe this is a resource that every thoughtful Christian should have. And right now, it's our special thanks to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support helps ensure that content like this podcast and so many others continue reaching people who are searching for wisdom, truth, and hope. So I encourage you to give today by visiting premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your copy today. Now, let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I guess the question we've got, sort of, you know, bringing it down to the ground, is could engaging with AI increase somebody's risk? If they're already psychotic, could it increase their risk? And I think there's a chance that it could. And I think particularly the risk is when there's a lack of social support and social engagement, because that's all they've got to rely on. And we certainly know that lack of social engagement is a risk factor anyway. When they've got an AI person who, you know, is feeding encouragement and corroborating their concerns, that is going to increase their risk. Their risk for not seeking help and realizing something's going wrong, their risk for not engaging with treatment, perhaps their risk for actually carrying out some of these things. So I have been concerned that some people might, cyber attacks, you know, be doing cyber attacks because of AI, because they're concerned about AI. I think the likelihood of that actually happening, how successful they might be with that, is another question. But, you know, I think there are risks that could escalate, particularly because of the nature of the interaction you have with AI. You're not left to your own devices. There's an amplification.
Yeah, that's right.
The feedback loop, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because technically, I think the big companies like OpenAI and Google and Meta and so on, they're well aware of this. And I think they're very worried that they're about to be have some massive legal claims against them. But technically, actually solving the problem is very difficult, because the theory is that the AI would say, well, this is a rather weird idea, you know, like your mom, in other words. It would say, you know, are you sure about this? And perhaps you need to speak to that nice, friendly Dr. Morn who maybe you need to talk to him about this. But the problem is that these models don't really have an understanding of the real world. So they don't know what's the difference between common sense, reality, and what it might be, the MI5. How do they know? You know, so they're just responding to the words and to the emotions. So how do you fix this so that these models actually do provide sensible, commonsensical advice is a good question.
And that, I mean, I wouldn't want to put any limits on AI, but I would say that, you know, I will often see somebody who's psychotic with perhaps a junior doctor or medical student, and they'll come back to me and say, but how do you know that's not true? What they're saying isn't true. So they've been completely convinced by it. And I tell you what, some people can be very convincing. And, you know, some things are bizarre, you know, like, I've seen aliens coming out of, you know, next door neighbor's house, and they want to invite me up on a cup of tea on planet Zog. There is a bit of that, but there's also very realistic stuff, like my neighbors don't like me and they're plotting to, you know, undermine me and report me to the police. You know, that's a lot more believable. Mm-hmm. So you've got to really, and this is where you can't rely on words, John, because it's so much more than that. It's their presentation. It's how they are in the room. It's their sense of, you know, suspiciousness that they have towards you that you pick up in assessment. It's the lifestyle that has, sort of perhaps deteriorated, that gives you this much bigger picture of whether this might be psychosis or not. Mm-hmm. I would struggle to see how AI could ever tap into those things if all they've got is the words from the person themselves.
I had a really fascinating conversation with another psychiatrist a while ago who's talking about this same issue, and he said he'd actually done some kind of testing where he'd fired up ChatGPT or one of the competitors and had started pretending to be a person who was experiencing some kind of severe depression and was having suicidal thoughts. And then all of a sudden started asking questions about what was the tallest building in the town where I live, and is it publicly accessible, and are there any kind of like railings? And obviously, and he said, if as a psychiatrist, if I experienced that in person, immediately that would be a red flag. This person is thinking about ways they might hurt themselves. Whereas the AI was like, what a great question. Let me just go, well, actually, it's over 100 meters tall, and you know, and the opening hours are here to get access to this balcony. And just they had none of that kind of semantic greater awareness of, let's put these two conversations together and think what actually is happening inside a living flesh and blood human being, rather than just, oh, another great prompt. Let's fire up the neurons and see what happens next and when what the program spits out.
And that the risk there is the access to means. So with suicide risk, we know that, you know, if somebody's got a gun in their house, that the risk goes up because they've got the access to the means. And what you're showing there is that AI gives people all the information that they need to do what they want, whether that's good or bad. And certainly with it, when it comes to suicide, you know, this is not information we want publicly available for people to just know about and where to buy it or which buildings to go to. This is really not helpful because some people are struggling with, do I, don't I? And a big part of them doesn't want to do it. But if they know how easy it is to do it, that's going to help them, you know, make the decision for, isn't it?
Yeah, and tragically, that's exactly what is coming to light in some of these recent cases, where the legal cases are now being. There's a tragic case of a young boy who, you know, had this very intense, ongoing relationship, quotes, with one of these agents, and the transcript has actually been made available. And when you read it, it's absolutely horrifying because it is giving this very detailed encouragement about how, you know, about a way of killing yourself and actually making advice about, you know, how to do it. And also what would be the best way of avoiding your parents knowing that you were doing this. And, I mean, it's just extraordinary and deeply disturbing how this kind of, how it could happen. And it's one of those unforeseen things, isn't it? You know, so often in technology, you know, you have this wonderful whizzy technology and you think this is going to be so useful and so helpful and all the rest. And lo and behold, something pretty well unforeseen, I think, is now becoming a very major problem.
Yes. And we do recognize that there is, you know, there's a contagion element to suicide. And, you know, in the trust I work in, you know, we're very careful about not putting certain types of people together on the ward if we can avoid it, because of that sense that they can share information with each other and, you know, develop suicide pacts and things like this. And, you know, I think the government are work hard to try and close down sort of, you know, these pro-suicide websites. So we know that, you know, this, you know, having information at your fingertips and knowing more is bad when it comes to suicide risk. And here we've got, you know, the easiest way to get all of that information and not only just present it to you as fact, but present it to you in a friendly, conversational way that almost normalizes it. Mm-hmm. You know, we also know that, you know, if you've got a member of the family who's committed suicide, that increases your suicide risk. Why? Because it's normalized. People can die like this. We don't want it normalized. You know, it needs to be seen as something which is, you know, is extreme and kind of, you know, difficult and, you know, bad, so that it has a stigma, not for people who've done it, but for people approaching it, so that they kind of want to avoid it.
I mean, this is so interesting because, just as an aside, there's exactly the same concern about assisted suicide, the legalizing of assisted suicide, that when you get highlighted media coverage of somebody who's killed themselves, you know, at Dignitas or whatever they've done, that, again, this phenomenon of suicide contagion, you know, so if we legalize assisted suicide, we're normalizing it. And, you know, what's going to happen to suicide contagion? So the law is being presented as actually reducing suicide because we've made this legal mechanism. But I'm afraid the fears are it'll be exactly the reverse.
Yes. And I think there is something about the accessibility of AI just being right there, you know, because there is something, you know, people fluctuate, you know, when they're suicidal. Sometimes they're not suicidal, sometimes they are. And to have that accessibility in your bedroom, on your laptop, ask a question, you get all the information, you know, it's concerning to have that so readily available. And I think there is something to be said for, you know, people in those vulnerable states when they're reaching out, they need to be reaching out to somebody who loves them, who cares for them, who can say words of encouragement and support rather than providing information. You know, and the trouble is that we're going in a way where people are reaching more for AI than relationships. And I think that's probably my tipping point. Do I have a problem with AI? No, not as a fundamental basis. Do I have a problem with people looking towards AI before they have actually proper face-to-face intimate relationships with other people? Yes, I do. I really have a problem there. And there's this artificial sense of, I think we lose, you know, artificial sense of what a relationship is, which we've already had with social media. And we know that relationships based on social media are not supportive for mental health as a proper relationship in the real world is, even though, you know, there's some disagreement, but, you know, it in literature, but generally they're not supportive. And we really must, we're creatures who need to live in community. We need to be visible, you know, and vulnerable and, you know, speaking honest words to each other about how we are.
Hmm. And that's particularly relevant, isn't it, for us as Christians? I think this idea of, you know, trying to uphold the value of face-to-face fleshly kind of relationships, even in our incredibly kind of digitalized age, whether that's through traditional social media or kind of new relationships with directly with AI, there's something, I think there's a kind of prophetic witness almost for the church to say, actually, we still believe that humans were made primarily for relationship with each other, not with machines, not with created tools, not disembodied through screens and phones and the internet, but in the same room, in breathing the same air.
There is a vulnerability that we bring when we are face to face with each other that's so very important to developing trust, to developing self-esteem, to having an understanding of what it means to be a human. I think absolutely, Tim, you're so right. And I think this, you know, there's a concern about this, you know, mimicking of humanity that I'm sure we will find, you know, there will be problems with that. I mean, you know, I'm not saying there's not going to be benefits, but we will lose a sense of, you know, something of ourselves. Because we find ourselves in the other. I do really think that. We find ourselves in others.
There's another interesting thing I've only recently tumbled into about human-to-human relationships, and that is that the carer in your working case is actually paying a cost to be present. In other words, you know, you've got lots of other things to do. You've got lots of other patients to see, but I have chosen as a consultant to spend this time with you, and this is costly. And that very aspect, that genuine face-to-face relationships always have some element of cost, which just isn't true with ChatGPT. You just press a button and it just spews it out. There's no cost involved.
ChatGPT at any one moment is in relationship with, at this point, hundreds of millions of people simultaneously.
What
at no cost.
I would say there's a very significant carbon cost, though, John.
Yes, true.
That is true, carbon cost,
but perhaps people aren't seeing that. No, and I think you're right. There is a sense of value that we place on people when we look to support them in their recovery. And yes, I would struggle to see how AI would impart that sense of value, intrinsic value that a person has, irrespective of their experience, because of who they are. They're a human being. We care about you. We're here to support you. I think that's so important for good recovery.
Just briefly as we end, we've talked a lot about the risks and the harms of AI in a kind of mental health context. Could you foresee a world where, maybe not the current versions, but in a world down the line where you might be prescribing a large language model to a patient, you know, not to replace you as the human psychiatrist, we hope, but as an additional therapeutic tool where you say, look, go and spend some time talking to this. It's been trained to give really kind of like grounded, evidence-based, helpful therapeutic responses. And that might help you manage some of your symptoms before you next come back to see me in my clinic.
So that wouldn't be replacing me necessarily. It'd be replacing my wonderful psychology colleague, the psychologists. And what have I found at the moment? I've found that lots of people are looking to AI for therapy, and that on the whole, they generally don't find it that helpful. They find it good, very helpful source of information, but not that therapeutically valuable. And again, it comes back to what you're saying, John, about that human-to-human, face-to-face interaction that's so important. And we, you know, in psychology, you know, all the way back to Freud and Jung, they saw immense value in what we call the therapeutic relationship. Mm-hmm. And there's something that having a relationship with someone tells you so much about the problems that person encounters. And you can speak into them in a very intuited, insightful way as a psychologist, that people don't, you know, that people don't know the problems that they have. You know, okay, I've come with depression, but I don't know that it's because I had a critical stepdad who always put me down and was, you know, quite frightening. I don't know that. I don't know that's the origin. A good psychologist would know that. But I do think for more simplistic mental health problems, yes, sure. And certainly we're already seeing very, you know, sophisticated CBT models that are very, you know, bespoke to you. So you put in all of your stuff and it will make you a bespoke sort of treatment for that problem. And you have apps that help you with sleep. There are some really good sleep apps out there. But when you get to the complexities of, you know, more existential, you know, identity, meaning, purpose problems, you know, where do I fit in kind of questions, you know, narrative difficulties, you know, what story am I telling in my life? Am I a failure? Am I, you know, I would struggle to see how an AI might have the ability to really go there, because of, as I said, the problems are often unknown to the person themselves.
Yeah, and you know, to be honest, speaking as someone who's had the privilege of, as a patient, of having a period of psychotherapy with a very experienced psychotherapist, I can totally see that. I mean, it's so much about the human person, about this therapeutic relationship, about trust, about all this intuition going on, his experience, you know, that a human being has accumulated over sometimes decades of clinical experience. It was just a remarkable positive experience for me. I mean, I have to say I was quite reluctant to have psychotherapy, but having had that experience, I can really vouch for it. And it's very hard to believe, however clever the machine, that it could ever reproduce that.
But I would say I'm all up for technology being helpful. You know, without saying, I don't think there's necessarily replacing, but there might be augmenting. And I would say that there, you know, I think we already see how, you know, social media connects people in a wonderful way. You know, we see how having information about, you know, what mental health problems look like is really helpful, you know, in destigmatizing these problems. We obviously don't want people diagnosing themselves, but it's really helpful to destigmatize you know, so I think there's huge benefits that we'll see from AI, but, you know, as with everything, you know, even from, you know, marriage or lovely relationships, they can be wonderful. They can actually also be really difficult and undermine mental health. And I think, you know, we need to look at technology like that too.
So just to close, I mean, it's quite likely that somebody listening to this podcast is thinking, you know, this is making me concerned about somebody they know, a family member, you know, whatever. What's your advice? What's the next steps for somebody? You know, I'm just, it's not absolutely obvious, but somebody's got this, it seems to be exacerbating certain negative tendencies. You know, what's Dr. Morn's advice?
Thanks, John. Well, I would say, you know, speak to somebody, speak to a close friend that you trust, speak to a family member that you trust, go and speak to your GP, your family doctor. I would say perhaps reflect critically on how much you're spending time with AI and the content of that. And is it useful? Is it bringing you, is it bearing fruit? Is it helpful? Is it a bit destructive? Is it pulling you away from things that are actually quite important for you as a person? And if that's the case, you ought to probably pull back a little bit from that. And there is nothing better than engaging positively in a community of people who are mutually supportive. And if you can step more into something like that, whether that's a local volunteer group or a home group or even at work or whatever, if there's a social group mutually supportive, step into that, trust people, open up a bit.
If you're worried about someone else, a close family member, is it ethical to breach confidentiality and contact someone medical, contact the GP?
It's never illegal or unethical to contact a healthcare professional if you have concerns about anyone. And sometimes it's really important that you do. But the principle should always be the best thing is that the person goes themselves or is encouraged to make the right decision themselves. If you're concerned about that leading to a heated argument and then you might be posing a risk to yourself, then yes, to speak to the GP or even the police is a reasonable measure if you're very concerned. But it's always best if you approach the person and gently, patiently, kindly challenge them about what's going on and see what their response is. And based on that, you can see whether it's going to be possible to get them to see their GP.
Well, that seems like a good place to end. Thank you so much, Dr. Morn, for your clinic today. It's been a huge, huge help for me. I've learned a lot. It's been really fascinating talking through some of these unexpected issues that have come up in the last few years. And thank you for sharing your time with us and our listeners. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We'd love to know your own thoughts. Are you a regular ChatGPT user? Have we maligned AI too much? Please do get in touch or suggestions for other things that we could talk about on the podcast. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. And as always, have a look at Dad's website, johnwhite.com. Lots of interesting material there. But we'll wrap it up there. Thanks very much for listening. Thank you, Daniel. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Parts puede ayudarte a revisar tu Luz Check Engine, Luz ABS o Luz de mantenimiento con O'Reilly Veriscan. El servicio es gratis y recibirás un informe con soluciones verificadas por técnicos maestros certificados ASE. Si necesitas ayuda, O'Reilly Auto Parts te puede recomendar un taller. Pregunta por O'Reilly Veriscan hoy mismo. Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.